All right, so we're going to get started with our next session and our last session for actually the day, which is Hot Topics. This session will explore a range of evolving topics, including AI, digital assets, event contracts, 24/7 trading, and regulatory changes. And with us today, we have Lou Baradaco, Steve Coleman, Tyler Kovac, and Angela Okot. I'll pass it on to them.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lou Baradaco. I'm a director in NFA's Member Oversight Department. As Matt kind of just mentioned, this is our final session today that's going to explore several evolving topics that continue to generate significant interest and discussion across the industry, including AI, digital assets, event contracts, 24/7 trading, and recent regulatory changes. While there is considerable dialogue surrounding each topic, many questions remain unanswered, and the path forward is still taking shape. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce our panelists. All the way to my left is Steve Coleman, who is a senior manager in our Member Oversight Department. Directly next to me is Tyler Kovac, and next to him is Angela Alcott. They're both managers in our Member Oversight Department. Given the topics that we have today, we'll be moving through each fairly quickly. Please hold any questions if you can for this panel until the end, because I have a feeling that if we just did one topic and then opened it up to questions, we might be here for the full 45 minutes for questions. So let's just dive right in. Last year, there was a lot to cover with respect to digital assets, but things have pretty much tapered off. Steve, what's the current state of affairs regarding digital assets?
All right. Thanks, Lou. I'm going to start with a few comments about the repeal of Interpretive Notice 9073. So the interp was introduced in 2018 to address initial concerns about digital asset products attracting customers that may not fully understand, the nature of those investments, the risk of loss, and the limitations on NFA's oversight role at the time. And the interp was very specific, and it quickly became outdated. So NFA's board voted to rescind the interp this past December. It is worth saying that for CPOs and CTAs, while the interp has been rescinded, you still have to disclose material risks related to your digital asset offerings. So with that being said, I'm going to move on to tokenized collateral. The CFTC Market Participants Division issued No Action Letter 2540 in late 2025, allowing FCMs to treat certain non-security digital assets, and I'm talking stablecoin, Bitcoin, Ether, as eligible customer margin collateral under defined conditions. FCMs can also use the value of these assets in customer segregation computations, and haircuts for margin and margin value and capital were included in the letter. FCMs may also deposit their own stablecoins as residual interest in customer accounts, despite restrictions in existing segregation rules, provided capital changes or capital charges and risk controls are applied. Firms must also implement enhanced risk management programs under Regulation 1.11, including ongoing monitoring of liquidity, volatility, collateral liquidation capacity, and daily stress considerations. And the No Action Letter also included additional reporting requirements for FCMs. Specifically, FCMs are required to submit a weekly report of digital asset holdings to NFA. I think I was mentioned earlier, we are seeing Bitcoin, Ether, and stablecoin accepted as collateral right now, with stablecoin the most popular form of tokenized value in use. And we actually foresee an increase in FCMs accepting and utilizing tokenized assets as cash-like collateral, benefiting funding and other activity like 24/7 settlements. So overall, for tokenized assets or collateral, firms should be mindful of segregation of customer funds, margin collateral acceptability, capital charges, liquidation, and risk control. Those are really the main points so far. So I'm going to move on to exam-related content. And I did mention a few firms, but the vast majority of our member firms that are conducting digital asset activities right now are CPOs, CTAs. So I'm going to focus on them with these next few comments. So in terms of the activities that we're seeing at these firms, most of it has been spot and derivative trading through centralized digital asset exchanges. Less frequently, we've seen activity going on at or through decentralized platforms. And this is largely consisted of staking, mining, lending, and providing liquidity. Over the last year, our exams have really been geared towards identifying and evaluating the risk of digital asset activities, then taking that information away and updating and streamlining our testing and exam process to make sure that we're just addressing relevant risk. Along with that, when it comes to some of the more decentralized activities, we do spend a lot of time just speaking with our firms to gain an understanding of the digital asset platforms, the protocols, and the coins and tokens that they're using. I think one big exam item you would see is if you have wallets or activity that occurs directly on a blockchain. In these cases, you should expect NFA to trace out that activity and follow transfers and funds on the blockchain. Verify control of wallet private keys for self-custodied wallets. And in certain situations, do trade reconstructions and follow the activity step-by-step through to financials. And again, if you're doing something we haven't seen much of, you should expect that we're going to be asking a lot of questions. We're going to be seeking to do detailed walkthroughs. We're going to look to get explanations and support for whatever it is you're doing. It goes back to needing to get a full understanding of what you're doing so that we can understand and evaluate those risks on our end. So as it relates to some common sites we're seeing at digital asset firms, a lot of it's been promo related, and specifically when it comes to performance, we're actually seeing in a lot of cases firms that want to capture outsized gains on coins and tokens over the past however many years, in some cases even before the firm was a member. Sometimes the results are hypothetical, sometimes they're proprietary, but firms are just taking this data and combining it with actual customer results and not doing a really good job of explaining what's what. We're also seeing issues with these firms maintaining records to substantiate the performance and having issues with disclosures surrounding the activity. Other than that, for digital asset firms, we are seeing a lot of general compliance items that aren't really necessarily specific to digital asset firms. Things like making sure people are properly registered, not having adequate written supervisory procedures, not doing required training. And, you know, a lot of this is not unexpected. I mean, a lot of these firms were quick to get registered and start activity and maybe didn't really spend a lot of time flushing out the compliance piece of it. And we kind of expect that to be the case going forward. The last bullet here is about monitoring legislation and potential impacts. You know, NFA is actively monitoring developments and proposed legislation. And with that, we're thinking about how we need to modify things on our end if additional requirements or responsibilities come our way. But I think if you look at the history of NFA, there have been other influxes of different types of firms. And I'm thinking retail Forex, I'm thinking swap firms. And I think if you look at those examples, I think NFA has shown that we've been able to quickly adapt and handle those new products and firms coming in a fairly smooth manner. And we expect it to be the same end result for digital asset firms. And that's all I have.
Thanks, Steve. So Tyler, when it comes to the world of prediction markets and event contracts, what are we seeing?
All right. So this is what everybody came here for, huh? So we'll address the elephant in the room here related to event contracts and prediction markets. Can anybody hear me okay? Okay. So there are a few nuances to these, but primarily event contracts are being recognized as cleared swaps, which require collateral to be fully posted prior to trade execution. However, at some different exchanges, such as CME, these may be considered options on futures, depending on the different contract specifications that are related to the contract. And then in those cases, they will be treated in a traditional manner when it comes to your regulatory requirements. These contracts act like binary options, which for a set premium upon purchase, the contracts will either pay out a defined amount, established in advance, or nothing at all. As of right now, these are unleveraged products that may be disintermediated, meaning customers may not be using an FCM and may be going directly to a DCM. So most of these contracts appear as structured exchange-traded products that are listed on DCMs and then cleared through DCOs. These can be related to financial data like the price of gold, entertainment, sports, the weather, and election outcomes, which is drawing a different customer base to cleared swaps, certainly than we've seen in the past. Retail participation in swaps is a recent development, which heightens the need for members to monitor for new risks with that type of customer base. These prediction markets are also operating in a 24/7 trading environment, which will have an impact on the firm's regulatory operations. So that's important to keep in mind too. So there's different relevant rules and regulations here. The first one being NFA registration rules. So every firm that is registered as an FCM, an IB, a CPO, and a CTA that engages in activities involving swaps are subject to the jurisdiction of the CFTC and must be properly registered with the NFA as a swap firm. Additionally, this also means that firms have a bylaw 1101 requirement to ensure that individuals or firms that the firm is doing business with related to this space are properly registered if required or maintain an exemption. Swap firms must have at least one principal who is registered as an associated person and is approved as a swap AP, which obviously entails proficiency exam requirements for individuals. So keep those things in mind. One thing that I wanted to highlight here is the importance of FCMs when it comes to prediction contracts and event contracts and prediction markets. So within the intermediated structure of using an FCM, where trading activity flows through that FCM, there's a critical role that's provided to help safeguard customers and other member firms. Specifically, there are numerous financial-related protections, facilitation of fully collateralized payments, and protections of customer funds. There's also onboarding, KYC, disclosure oversight, as well as supervisory requirements of FCMs that come into play here. We'll hit on this a bit more later when we discuss NFA's comment letter and how those relate to DCMs. So additional NFA-related requirements here that impact FCMs specifically are minimum net capital requirements for FCMs that operate in this space, which may include monthly reporting requirements and notice filings based on certain parameters. There's also NFA financial requirements section 4. This is related to cleared swaps collateral that must be reported to NFA. FCMs are also registered, required, to notify NFA of distributions and submit daily filings. There's also NFA financial requirements section 16, which relates to FCMs needing policies and procedures to maintain a residual interest target of excess customer funds. And have controls in place related to disbursement of residual interest related to cleared swaps customer accounts that come to mind. There's also various FCM-related CFTC regulations. Cleared swaps, if you didn't know, have their own set of regulatory requirements under CFTC's Part 22, which involves different margin reporting, collateral requirements, and different protections. Though many of these requirements also mirror or reference Part 1 requirements that you may be used to as an FCM. There's also different CFTC-related regulations here that come into play. Three areas that I wanted to talk about specifically is related to FCMs needing to issue daily trade confirmations and monthly statements. Additionally, the treatment of collateral, legally separated but operationally commingled funds, daily computation, and residual interest requirements. There's also disclosures related to cleared swaps customers related to DCO rules, collateral use, and default procedures. So areas of focus that you might interact with NFA during an exam or during other different annual requirements. First is the annual member questionnaire, which is collecting information on event contracts, which includes questions on customer and non-customer activity. Next, on exams for FCMs and IBs, much of the focus will be a lot like what you're traditionally used to during an exam, including testing in different compliance areas and firm financials. So that includes some of the things that we discussed earlier today, such as AML, sales practice, disclosures, risk management, and books and records. It also includes capital testing and internal controls related to these types of funds. Areas of concern specifically related to prediction markets that we've started to come to during examinations is related to the issue of customer statements. This is really important here. Firms must include on the customer statements futures, options, and cleared swaps activity. They also must issue trade confirmations on a daily basis related to cleared swaps, and monthly statements as well must be distributed to customers. There's also concern here related to the flow of funds. Since prediction markets are 24/7 and accounts may be immediately funded, it's important that the firm keeps in mind delays in fund settlement and maintain controls over the reconciliation process. There's also promotional material where existing rules still apply and material cannot be misleading or unbalanced if you're looking to get new customers in the space. A reminder, you're mostly dealing with retail investors here until it picks up more in the institutional side of things. Lastly, I wanted to hit on the supervision of this type of activity. So there's existing rules in place to supervise activity that still apply under NFA compliance rule 2-9. There is also different CFTC actions in prediction markets that we have begun seeing. The CFTC has made it extremely clear that the misuse of material non-public information, fraud tactics, deceit, manipulation in these markets will be enforced. We've actually seen a couple of these actions come across. We saw one recently in coordination with the CFTC and the DOJ related to a Google engineer who was using information that he accessed in his role to bet on prediction markets related to the top search result on Google at the end of the year. There's also different advisory notices that the CFTC has issued related to smaller contracts in coordination with a DCM. This is related to a producer that worked for Mr. Beast that was betting on event contracts related to the information that he was aware of that was non-public, that had a direct outcome on the event contract itself and made only a couple thousand dollars on that one. Additionally, there's also another action that took place related to a gubernatorial candidate in California who bet a couple hundred dollars on his own election outcome there. So it's very clear here that there could be million-dollar trades that are made, but there could also be smaller ones. But at the end of the day, the thought process is clear here. It still fits under the CEA as something that is not allowable.
All right. Thank you, Tyler. So trading hours, they've gone from 23 hours a day, 5 days a week, to now 24/7, changing the way we all do business. Steve, can you share with us some key issues around 24/7 trading?
Yeah, I'm going to mostly talk about the Joint Audit Committee Regulatory Alert 2601 and the NFA comment letter dated May 2025. But a few quick observations first. So we have noted DCMs currently offering or planning to offer trading on a 24/7 basis. 24/7 listings are mostly limited to the crypto and event contract asset classes. And we have noted several registered FCMs that have already rolled out 24/7 trading. So in addition, though, we've also noted other derivative contracts listed on a 23/5 basis. So some of the language in these letters might talk about near continuous versus continuous. So anything outside of normal business hours is kind of what we're talking about. And both letters have similar messages, reinforcing that regulatory compliance does not pause outside of non-business hours. And regulation will need to evolve as the broader market adopts expanded hours. 2601 included guidance addressing risk from near 24/7 trading environments. The alert focuses on the growing interest of continuous or near continuous trading and was a reminder that FCM regulatory obligations remain fully in effect during non-business hours, including overnight and weekends. Firms are required to maintain up-to-date and update policies and procedures that account for 24/7 trading when setting residual interest targets and managing customer fund protections and account for non-business hours as the period between U.S. business days plus weekends. FCMs must also remain in continuous capital compliance, with obligations to monitor financial conditions in real time, rather than just relying on end-of-day business processes. And firms are expected to maintain robust record keeping, including pro forma calculations, back office reports, and trade data that demonstrate compliance at all times. So NFA's comment letter from May of 2025 notes that with the push towards more 24/7 trading, we hope the commission considers and assesses the impact on many areas impacting NFA members, such as reporting, and compliance timelines to help eliminate potential transparency gaps over weekends related to items such as segregation reporting and financial monitoring, residual interest compliance, RMP requirements, and the importance of enhanced customer disclosures, particularly for retail participants, so customers can understand risks such as weekend market volatility, liquidation risk, and continuous exposure, even when they're not actively trading.
All right, great. Thanks, Steve. So next, artificial intelligence. It's obviously talked about everywhere. Tyler, can you tell us a little bit about what we're seeing in regards to relevant rules and exam expectations?
Sure. Thanks, Lou. So although artificial intelligence isn't new, it's certainly much more readily available and has shown a few use cases for our member firms already that could impact you. So it's important to be mindful about how that could impact the firm operations and also create new risks. So there's a number of relevant rules that govern AI here that fit into the normal NFA compliance rules. So one is NFA Compliance Rule 2-9, which requires member firms to diligently supervise its employees and its agents. That specifically also includes AI agents. The big takeaway here is that firms need to supervise how it's implementing AI and how its employees are using it. The member firms are ultimately responsible for this AI-based activity and its outcomes that it may produce as it relates to its NFA operations. It's also important that the information is validated, not blindly relied on, as there could be different inaccuracies or hallucinations related to the output. This also fits into NFA Compliance Rule 2-29, which current promotional material rules in place govern the use of AI to produce promotional material, websites, or have communications facing the public. We're starting to see firms utilize AI-generated content, and so it's important to remember that it's your content, regardless of how it was made or who made it, to ensure it fits and complies with NFA compliance rules. This includes the likelihood of deceit, material misstatement of fact, balance risk loss discussions, disclosures, adequate performance information, and testimonials. There's also two interpretive notices that fit related to AI, and that's 9070, which is cybersecurity-related procedures, and also 9079, which is relying on TPSPs to perform regulatory functions on behalf of the firm. So as you know, AI can certainly create a heightened cybersecurity risk. So it's important to factor in these risks and unintended vulnerabilities when drafting an ISSP and evaluating third parties that the firm utilizes. So data security when using AI can be called into question. Is the AI local to the firm's computer, its network, and is it secure? Are third parties the firm contracts with using AI and have access to firm or customer data? What protections do they have in place? And are you still comfortable with the agreement if not? AI can also be utilized by bad actors externally to find vulnerabilities within firm systems or through a third party that may have access as well. Advancements in this area are allowing more individuals to have the ability to become bad actors and speeding up the possibilities of breaching the firm's network environment. These are just a few things to think about going forward as we continue to see AI develop, different potential use cases, and any data security repercussions. One other item that I wanted to note here is that there's also a risk related to the onboarding process. FinCEN, over the past few years, has issued guidance related to using generative AI to forge different types of documentation, including photographs and information, when opening customer accounts. So it's important to be mindful of that. There's also different red flags that they highlight within that notification related to looking at the metadata, meeting with customers in person. Are there any inconsistencies across the data that they gave you and what you know about the customers, as well as any information related to their bank account activity that you may not know? Are there material transactions, money moving in and out very quickly and often? These could be red flags to note. So different exam-related expectations when interacting with NFA. So NFA is still gathering information on firms' use of generative AI. Every exam asks firms within the firm exam questionnaire if the firm or any third parties the firm utilizes generative AI for any functions, including regulatory ones specifically. Based on the firm's response, you'll be giving an additional questionnaire covering areas such as governance, risk management, use cases, oversight, and different trainings of the model. Exam teams may also consider utilizing AI, consider any utilized AI when it reviews your cybersecurity policies and your TPSP procedures in the event that that's something that needs to be incorporated based on the firm's function. Lastly, exam teams may perform walkthroughs of the members' use of AI when it comes to different regulatory functions like internal controls, financial preparation, record keeping, or surveillance processes.
Thanks, Tyler. All right, so Tyler talked a little bit about the use of AI in advertising. Angela, what other trends are we starting to see in promotional material?
Thanks, Lou. So before I get into some hot topics under the digital engagement umbrella, first and foremost, members should make sure that the promotional material they're using is not deceptive or likely to mislead the public. Narrowing in on some areas to be cautious, though, as time goes on, we're seeing an increasingly large amount of advertising taking place on social media platforms. Different platforms have different limitations. So X, formerly Twitter, for example, has a character limit per tweet. That said, NFA's rules still apply even if you're facing a character limit or some other limitation. So for example, members that discuss hypothetical results in a tweet still need to find a way to include that hypothetical disclaimer language. One thing we've seen some of our members do is embed a picture in their tweet, and in that picture, they'll include the required disclaimer language. And provided that the image is legible, that's a great way to ensure that you're meeting our requirements. We're also increasingly seeing members using third parties to generate new business. So we've seen members have agreements in place with social media influencers that produce futures or Forex content on online forums such as YouTube or Discord. In some cases, our members will coordinate with these influencers and provide discounts to any clients that sign up after watching that content. We've also seen instances where our members pay third-party advertising agencies to put out articles on their websites that explain why clients should do business with our member. When our members are using third parties to generate new business, the most important thing really is supervision. So of course, you want to make sure that what these third parties are saying isn't deceptive or misleading, but you also want to make sure that what they're saying is accurate. They shouldn't be saying that your commission rates are one thing when they're really another. Moving on to retail customers, overall, and especially with the popularity of prediction markets, we're seeing more retail customers in the commodity interest space. So now more than ever, it's important that your promotional material is clear and understandable to a retail customer. These retail customers might not be as sophisticated as you're used to or understand industry jargon. So keep that in mind when you're putting out new promotional material. It's also important that the customer is always clear on who they're doing business with. So if your member operates alongside a number of affiliates that offer different products, the client should always be clear on who exactly it is that they're doing business with, and the promotional material should be clear on that as well.
All right, great. So we've been talking about new products, tokenized collateral, the use of AI. And if I'm sitting here today and I'm a compliance officer, I'm nervous about approving promotional material that is marketing all this new types of stuff. Angela, what does NFA offer that can help a CCO out?
Yeah, so if any members are curious about if their promotional material is compliant, they should utilize our promotional material pre-review program, where you'll submit to us promotional material that you intend to use, and we'll issue a comment letter outlining any compliance concerns that we see in regard to our promotional material rules. This program is free to use, and the turnaround time is generally 2 weeks. We do ask, though, if that you use it, you submit promotional material in the final form that you intend it to take so that we can, you know, adequately review it and identify any concerns with it. We also ask that you make this a collaborative process. So at the end of our review, we'll issue a comment letter, but that letter will be signed by someone and we'll have the phone number of the person who actually reviewed your promotional material. So you should give that person a call and talk through with them how your promotional material can be revised to ensure that you're meeting our requirements.
Okay, thanks. So NFA actively reviews our rules and makes changes when warranted. Angela, can you tell us about some recent and upcoming rule amendments?
Yeah, so starting with the March 31st, 2026 PQR and CTA form PR, financial ratios related to CPO and CTA members' financial condition are no longer required. And if they believe that these financial ratios could help inform exam priorities by identifying firms with financial difficulties that may impair their ability to operate in their customers' best interests. However, we found that the financial ratios have not been particularly helpful with identifying problematic firms. Also, NFA has since implemented Compliance Rule 250, which, as Tara mentioned in an earlier panel, requires that CPO members notify us if the CPO operates a commodity pool and they experience a market or other event that affects the ability to fulfill its obligations to pool participants. So for those reasons, we've removed the financial ratio requirement. Another recent update was to Compliance Rule 252. So this rule generally prohibits a CPO member from permitting a commodity pool to loan pool assets to an affiliated or related person or entity. It came to our attention that several large CPOs were having trouble with complying with the rule versus carrying out their intended investment strategies. So some strategies necessitated using pool loans or making pool loans to an affiliate. And that wasn't the type of transaction that we intended to prohibit when the rule was put in place back in 2009. We also changed the rule to level the playing fields a bit between exempt and non-exempt pools, so that our registrants are not prohibited from engaging in transactions that persons exempt from CPO registration can engage in. Therefore, NFA's board approved amendments to this rule, and now generally CPOs that have increased reporting requirements with the SEC are able to make some loans to affiliates. The amended rule also imposes certain conditions on a CPO to ensure that the loan is for the benefit of the pool's participants. I just want to highlight that the rule also now defines the term affiliated or related when previously it did not. So that should be helpful for our members when they're reviewing the rule and trying to determine if they can engage in a certain transaction. Moving on to member questionnaire attestations. Currently, Compliance Rule 252 requires that most members' member questionnaire is submitted by an individual who is both registered as an associated person and is listed as a principal of the member. However, since adding that requirement, member firms have indicated that sometimes complying with the requirement is difficult because the person who is most knowledgeable about the firm's operations and is best suited to submit the member questionnaire isn't required to be an AP and or principal. So oftentimes, the CCO is the person who really should be submitting the member questionnaire, but generally CCOs don't need to be registered as APs. Therefore, at last week's board meeting, our board approved amending this requirement to allow a listed principal or any other senior level individuals who are sufficiently knowledgeable about the member's ongoing business operations to review, sign, and submit the questionnaire. And then lastly, branch office managers. Last week, NFA's board also approved changes related to branch office manager requirements. These changes will permit a branch office manager to A, supervise more than one branch office, and B, do so remotely, provided that the member can demonstrate that it's appropriate under the circumstances. So a member is still required to ensure that each branch office has its own manager, unless the member has undertaken a risk-based analysis and based on that analysis has determined that a person can effectively supervise its APs at more than one branch office location. If that's the case, then the member would also be required to adopt and implement supervisory procedures reasonably designed to ensure that a branch office manager can effectively supervise its APs activities at more than one branch office. Similarly, before allowing a branch office manager to supervise remotely, our members would need to be required to develop and implement appropriate policies and procedures related to remote supervisory work arrangements. These last two items I touched on, member questionnaire attestations and branch office managers, those amendments are being submitted to the CFTC for review and approval, and NFA systems are being updated to account for these changes. So keep a lookout for upcoming notice to members about these items.
All right. Thank you, Angela. Before we get to questions, which I know you're dying to probably ask us, and we'll do our best to answer them or at least delegate them to the crowd. Thanks, Dale. I'm going to talk about two other regulatory changes. Hopefully you've seen NFA's notice to members on this, but as a reminder, effective October 1st, individuals required to provide fingerprints to NFA must submit them through our new service provider, Fieldprint. Fieldprint will electronically collect the fingerprints, submit them to the FBI for processing, and report these results to NFA. All member firms must activate an account before individuals can schedule a fingerprinting appointment. No need to wait till October, though. You can actually activate your account now and begin using this service right away as part of the registration process. You can also take a look at NFA's website if you have any questions, or you can also contact our information center for further details and assistance on that. Lastly, is the CME has announced that they will be launching a single stock futures this summer. As a reminder, single stock futures are classified as securities futures products, jointly regulated by both the CFTC and the SEC, and require FCMs and IBs offering these products to also be registered as a broker-dealer or a notice-registered broker-dealer. There's also an SFP training program that APs would also need to take. NFA, as a limited-purpose national securities organization, has been reviewing our rules governing these products for possible updates. More information from NFA will be distributed when it becomes available. Additional information, however, can be found on CME's website, including contract specifications and which single stock futures will be available. I also noticed on their website, you can actually sign up for updates if you'd like to. So other than that, I'm going to open it up to questions. Again, please, if you have any, just please wait for a microphone. Matt's coming around. And as I mentioned in the beginning of this session, there's still a lot of open-ended questions about any of the topics that were discussed today. So we'll do our best. But if we can't answer something, maybe we'll take it offline and get back to you. Thank you.
Hi, we've been using Fieldprint, and there's a little bit of confusion whether or not we have to actually follow with the paper cards, with the AP ID. Can you break the tie?
You do not need the paper cards anymore.
Nothing.
No, everything's electronic with the new system.
We heard it here.
It's recorded.
Similar question. We have a couple firms that are outside of the U.S. I don't know if it's my computer. And they're having trouble getting FBI fingerprint cards done to get registered as they live in places that are not in the U.S. So will Fieldpoint work there as well, like outside the U.S.?
It'll definitely work outside the U.S. And I would definitely say that if you do have any questions or nuances or things you can't figure out, definitely call our info center. There's definitely people that are versed in, I mean, I haven't seen the system firsthand, but there's definitely people at NFA that have and can walk them through it.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
This is the trifecta on fingerprinting. The current alternative procedures for people located outside the United States that they don't have to submit fingerprint cards, will those remain in effect?
Yes.
One of the things that wasn't discussed just now today was the no action letter 2550 regarding CPOs that are duly registered with the SEC and their ability to withdraw as CPOs. I was curious with that new rule, for firms that want to rely on it, is there anything, you know, firms that are filing withdrawals, is there anything holding up those withdrawals? Is there anything firms should keep in mind when going to submit that no action letter? And then on a similar topic, the reintroduction of 413A4, I've heard that there's discussions at the CFTC of that rule coming back or a version of it. Is there any color you could provide on that or anything that you'd be willing to answer on that rule coming back?
I touched on the first part. So I guess just things to remember with 2550 is make sure that you're reading through the letter. And when you email the CFTC indicating that you're relying on that letter, you include everything that you're required to include. So like the CPO's name, call out each individual pool that you intend to rely on 2550, things like that. Because once the CFTC gets those requests, they forward it on to us and we enter it in our systems. But if those emails sent to the CFTC aren't complete, then we kind of have to go back and get that information from you. But once you email the CFTC a reliance on 2550, if that applies to all of your pools or all of your pools are exempt from registration, the withdrawal process is kind of the same as it would be in any other circumstance where you'll still file your 7W and, you know, we'll process that withdrawal. put you on a halt if there's anything outstanding, but otherwise the withdrawal is similar, just like with any other firm that's withdrawing.
Yeah, and as far as the second part of your question, 413A4, I mean, ideally it's in the CFTC's hands at this point. I mean, we don't really have anything additional to share at this time.
Thank you. My question is related to the separate account margining, the CFTC rule that came out recently. Have you seen any challenges or any issues coming up during the exam process related to that?
Not anything outside of what we've already talked about. I mean, I haven't seen it on any exams, any firms taking advantage of that. So,
sorry. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Christy, and I'm the head of communications at NFA. I know there have been several questions on the new fingerprinting procedure. I just wanted to let you all know that one good resource for details on some of the nuances that you've asked about is Notice to Members I-2612, which we issued back on April 1st. So I definitely recommend referencing that. And then if you have further questions, we will be conducting additional education dedicated solely to field print and the new fingerprinting procedure in the coming months. So stay tuned for that.
Thank you, Christy. Any other questions before we wrap up?
All right. Thank you, everybody. If there's nothing else, I'm going to leave it to Matt for closing remarks. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lou, Tyler, Angela, and Steve. Once again, I would like to thank you all for attending today's program. We do hope that you will follow up with us if you have any further questions or any issues. If we did not get to your question today, you can always reach out to NFA's Information Center. They are very well equipped to answer your questions. And if they don't have the answer for you, they know who can answer that question so they can point you to that right individual. As always, NFA is committed to working with you towards your compliance. We appreciate the feedback that you have provided here today and also encourage you to tell us how we did via the workshop survey that you can find on our screen. It's a super quick and easy survey that will truly help us make these workshops better for you and tailor them. So please stay in contact with us. And we look forward to continuing our work together. Thanks again.